Well, strictly speaking then, the life of Joseph begins in biblical terms not in Genesis 37, but further back, Genesis chapter 30, verses 22 to 24. That's where we first meet this character. You could be forgiven if that passage, Genesis chapter 30, is not your favourite Bible passage. Genesis 30 recounts that rather depressing tussle between the two sisters, Leah and Rachel, as they're both so desperate to conceive and bear children with their shared husband, Jacob. And you remember how then in that tussle, Leah enjoys all the initial success, and her womb is fruitful, and Reuben is born to her, and Simeon is born to her, and then Levi is born to her, and then Judah is born to her. And all that time, Rachel, she's having no children. And in response, then Rachel gives her servant Bilhah to Jacob to conceive and bear children on her behalf. And that produces two boys then, Dan and Naphtali. That then gives Leah ideas, and she gives her servant Zilpah to Jacob to conceive and bear children on her behalf. And so it is that Gad and Asher are both born. Leah then has three more children without any help from her servant girl, Issachar, Zebulun, and Dinah, the girl. They are all born. And then finally, after all of that, finally Rachel too does have a child without the help of her servant Bilhah, and that child is Joseph. So strictly speaking, as I say, that's where the narrative of Joseph begins. But after that notification of his birth there in chapter 30, we're told nothing of Joseph's early years until he bursts onto the scene here in chapter 37, now a 17-year-old lad. And so this is the passage then that we're going to focus on this evening. It's a long passage. I'm in no way going to give you a blow-by-blow exposition of it. Rather, we're going to step back a little from it and survey three main themes within it. So notice with me, first of all then, an undiminished sovereignty. That's our first heading this evening, an undiminished sovereignty. So we're entering here then into the last section of the book of Genesis. We have a brother with us here this evening who's from the United States of America. And the United States, of course, is a country so vast that it encompasses different time zones, encompasses different climates. And so I suppose that you can fly from one part of the States to another and step off the plane, and you're in such a different setting that you perhaps wouldn't think you're still in the same country. And it's a bit like that with Genesis. Genesis is so vast and it's so diverse. As we enter into this last section, you almost wouldn't think that we're in the same book still as some of the earlier sections of Genesis. It's all so ordinary now. Now, I don't mean that in a derogatory sense at all. I don't mean that Genesis 37 to 50 are dull and uneventful, far from it. The life of Joseph, as we all know, is a real roller coaster ride. It's a real page turner, I'm sure, for many of us. It is one of our favourite biblical narratives. No, when I say that it's ordinary, I mean it's ordinary in the sense it's full of natural, this-worldly events. It's all family feuds and sexual temptation and wrongful imprisonments and famines and political promotions and so on. Things that your secular colleagues and neighbours would have no problem at all reading about and accepting. There's no in-your-face divine supernatural dimension in Genesis 37 to 50. That's really what I mean. We've come a long way from Genesis 1 to 3, where we have God speaking the universe into existence and walking with Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. We've come a long way from Genesis 4 to 11, where we have God sentencing the murderer Cain to his punishments and commissioning the building of the ark and coming down in order to inspect the Tower of Babel. We've come a long way from Genesis 12 to 25, where we have God forcefully breaking into the life of that pagan idol worshipper Abraham and sending angels to the city of Sodom and commanding and then aborting the sacrifice of Isaac. We've come a long way from Genesis 26 to 36, where we have God wrestling with Jacob and sending angels to meet Jacob at that place Jacob subsequently named Mahanaim. I mean, these kinds of things just don't happen in the Joseph narrative. So even though we're in the same book, it feels like we're not. Genesis 37 to 50, it kind of feels more like the book of Ruth or the book of Esther than the book of Genesis. The divine supernatural dimension has disappeared, or almost disappeared, but not quite. Because what we do have in Genesis 37 to 50 is three pairs of something. What do we have three pairs of? We have three pairs of dreams. Now, dreams, of course, are not as self-evidently supernatural as the universe being spoken into existence, or the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, or something like that. I mean, we all have dreams. And indeed, the pair of dreams then that we have in this passage, because the first pair comes here in Genesis 37. The pair of dreams we have in this passage, I mean, in terms of its content, it's probably less remarkable than some of your dreams, perhaps some dreams you even had in bed last night. And indeed, in this pair, God's not mentioned. He's not mentioned in the dream. He's not in the dreams. He's not mentioned in connection with the dreams at all. But you don't have to probe the Joseph narrative too much to realize, do you, that these three pairs of dreams are all supernatural, because they all predict accurately later developments in the story. In this case, in this pair of dreams here in chapter 37, it's predicting, of course, the very climax of the Joseph narrative, when his brothers there in the land of Egypt will bow down before him. I think then this can be easily overlooked. I think we often, with the dreams here, we get a bit obsessed with looking for moral lessons. In fact, as I'll say more than once, we, with the Joseph narrative generally, I think, get obsessed looking for moral lessons. And so with these dreams then, we kind of seize on Joseph's supposed arrogance here. The way in which he talks about these dreams he's had to his brothers, and it all seems so insensitive, and it seems a bit cocky and a bit impudent, and it's a nice moral lesson then for us to take away from the passage. We mustn't be arrogant in the way that Joseph is so arrogant here. Actually, there's not a hint, is there, in the way the narrator narrates the story? There's not a hint that Joseph is guilty of arrogance. The narrator doesn't seem remotely interested in laying that charge at Joseph's feet, or indeed the other charge that we hear so much about when we hear preaching on this passage, that Joseph is a telltale, that he goes and gives this bad report to his father, verse 2, about his brothers. And you know, that was a bit unsatisfactory as well, and he shouldn't really have done that. So we have all these moral lessons kind of bombarded at us so often in the way that Genesis 37 is handled. It's rather like the way that the David and Bathsheba narrative is so often handled. And we say, well, yes, David is a naughty man, but we can't entirely absolve Bathsheba blame because she was being immodest in her behaviour and so on. And here, similarly, well, yeah, these brothers, they were being bad by doing what they did to Joseph, but we can't absolve Joseph of all blame because, you know, he was being arrogant and telling tales and all the rest of it. On the contrary, the narrator seems, if anything, to be painting Joseph as a paragon of obedience. It's interesting the way that he responds to his father in verse 13, when Jacob sends him off to go and see his brothers. And what's Joseph's response? At the end of verse 13, he said to Jacob, "Here I am." Now that phrase, "here I am," that's echoing a key phrase in an earlier narrative in Genesis. Genesis 22, Abraham, twice to God, "Here I am." When God first says to him, "Sacrifice, go and sacrifice your son on Mount Moriah, here I am." And then later on, when he's about to do the deed, and he's got the knife lifted high, and the angel says, "Stop." And he says, "Here I am." And of course, the part of the point of Genesis 22 is Abraham's obedience. And here, Joseph is echoing that phrase then that is so associated with Abraham's obedience. And so I'm saying, if anything, at that moral level, Joseph is being portrayed here as a paragon of obedience, not at all as an arrogant telltale. But as I say then, we easily seize on these dreams as the evidence that Joseph was being a bit arrogant and a bit cocky, and we miss the main point of them. The main point of them is not Joseph's arrogance. The main point of them is that they foretell exactly how the story is going to end. And so here then, it may be understated and it may be low-key. It may not be like what we've encountered in earlier chapters of Genesis. But here we are seeing God's hand. These dreams are saying to us, God is involved here. God hasn't retired. He hasn't given up on the events of the book of Genesis. He's still involved. He's still sovereign. His sovereignty is undiminished. No less than in the days of creation. No less than the days of Sodom and Gomorrah. No less than in the days of wrestling with Jacob and all the rest of it. God is still in control. God is still directing things. God is still sovereign. This pair of dreams predicting the end of the story so accurately, it's saying that to us. And once we recognize that then, once we recognize that that's what the dreams are saying to us, that God is still in control here, then I think we start to see the hand of God, in this narrative at least, in all kinds of little details. Details comparable to those books I mentioned a moment ago, Ruth and Esther, where there are so many twists and turns, aren't there? And it's so obvious that things have been orchestrated here by a higher hand. You think of Ruth and the way that on that first day that she goes off to glean in the fields, she just happens to go into Boaz's field. Or you think of the book of Esther, and there's the king, and one night he can't sleep, and he calls for his books, the record of his reign, to be brought to him, and that's where he reads about Mordecai, and you know how the story unfolds, and these little chance things, and it's so evident there's a higher hand steering everything. And once we've recognized the significance of the dreams here, that they're telling us God is still sovereign, even in Genesis 37, we start to see that sovereignty in similar little details. For instance, Joseph then, he goes off looking for his brothers, and of course he gets to Shechem and his brothers aren't there anymore, and it seems then like he's just going to have to go back home and tell his father that they're not there. But no, he bumps into this man, and the man asks him what he's looking for, and he says, "I'm seeking my brothers." And it just so happens then that this man has overheard a conversation between those brothers and knows exactly where they've gone to, and he can redirect Joseph. Well, then there's that detail in verse 18. And the brothers are there at Dothan, and they see Joseph coming from afar, and they didn't have high definition binoculars in those days. Well, how are they able to see Joseph coming from afar? Well, of course, as we discover a bit later on, because he's wearing the coat that's so brightly coloured. And again, it's a chance little detail on the face of things. But once we've realised from the dreams God is in control, it fits. It's the higher hand at work. Or the way in which they're sitting there and they just look up and there's a caravan of Ishmaelites coming. And so the idea strikes them of selling Joseph. And I'm saying then that this drift towards Egypt, this move of Joseph from Hebron, where he starts with Jacob, to Egypt, suddenly we begin to see it's been steered by God. If there'd been no man who had overheard the conversation between the brothers, Joseph would have gone back home, wouldn't have ended up in Egypt. If the brothers hadn't been able to see Joseph from afar because he was wearing the coat, then they wouldn't have had time perhaps to formulate these plans. And again, Joseph might not have ended up in Egypt. If there'd been no caravan of Ishmaelites coming along at just the right time, again, Joseph wouldn't have ended up in Egypt. But God, you see, is controlling all these little details. And this then is something that makes Genesis 37 to 50, and for us tonight, Genesis 37, so relevant to us as believers in this new covenant age. An age in which God doesn't generally intrude on history in the same direct manner, the same conspicuous manner that we see in the early chapters of Genesis. And it's saying to us then that doesn't mean God is any less involved. The fact that we don't encounter the kinds of phenomena that we read of in most of Genesis, the angels appearing all the time, and this actual audible voice of God speaking to Cain and speaking to Noah and speaking to Abraham and so on, the fact that we don't encounter those phenomena doesn't mean that God is somehow more distant now, less involved in things. No, he's still sovereign. The God of Genesis 37 to 50, the God of the book of Ruth and the book of Esther, the God of our lives in 2017, just as sovereign, his sovereignty undiminished. Every twist and turn of your week, this week, will be because of this higher hand steering and orchestrating your life. As we began our service this evening, it's that great theme of the God who works out everything in conformity with the purpose of his will. Isn't that a comforting thought? There will be many twists and turns for all of us this week. Many things that aren't presently written in our diaries. And over all of them, God is sovereign. Nothing happening by chance. Nothing accidental. Nothing arbitrary. It's the theme we closed on this morning. Everything fitting. Everything appropriate. Because this God is undiminished in his sovereignty. So an undiminished sovereignty. Secondly, notice an unfolding story. An unfolding story. Now the treatment then that Joseph receives at the hands of his brothers is, of course, appalling. The way, I mean, we could we could itemize all sorts of aspects of it, couldn't we? The way in which they're so indifferent, for instance, towards their father in all of this. Okay, we might concede then that they just do hate Joseph implacably for various reasons to do with the father's favoritism and to do with the coat and to do with the fact that he's Rachel's child and all the rest of it. They hate him, but surely they have some sensitivity toward their dear aged father. But don't care about breaking his heart, do they? Or then again, the way in which they so callously sit down to eat there in verse 25. They've just thrown their brother into a pit. The plan at this point is still to kill him. And they're sitting down and having a good old meal together. In fact, we learn it's worse, don't we? In chapter 42, verse 21, we learn there that Joseph was begging them not to do this to him. And yet, with their brother pleading for his life, they're feasting. So callous. Or the way in which, of all people, they're willing to sell Joseph to the Ishmaelites. These enemies of Israel. Ishmael, of course, the son that Abraham had through Hagar. And remember how we read that prophecy in Genesis 16 about Ishmael. Genesis 16:12, he shall be a wild donkey of a man, his hand against everyone and everyone's hand against him, and he shall dwell over against all his kinsmen. That's the kind of people that the Ishmaelites were, and yet they're prepared to sell their brother to them. So the treatment he receives is appalling. And again, then, we're very quick, aren't we, to seize on lots of moral lessons arising from this, that we mustn't treat our siblings in the way that these brothers treated Joseph, and so on. And I guess there is some mileage in that moral lessons route. I mean, this family is Israel, isn't it? Israel is the people of God. And we are the people of God. We are the new covenant Israel. And so I think there are lines of application in that regard. Sadly, we're, as I mentioned in my prayer earlier tonight, we're not immune, are we? From our own, perhaps slightly more sanitized, squabbling and quarrelling and dividing as the new covenant family, the new covenant people of God. We sang Psalm 133. And what we have in Genesis 37 then is a failure to implement Psalm 133. And as the Church of Jesus Christ, we can often be guilty of that same failure. So we can think of it in those terms. Indeed, just the very fact then that Joseph here, he goes to Shechem where his brothers were. And as one commentator puts it, Joseph alone and vulnerable is safer with a Shechemite than with his brothers. I mean, the Shechemites, that's the people that there's been that massacre of by Levi and Simeon back in chapter 34. These are people that you wouldn't expect to treat one of Jacob's sons gently. And yet, the Shechemite treats Jacob's son fine. It's Jacob's sons that don't treat Jacob's son fine. And again, there's perhaps application there in that, tragically, is it not sometimes the case that believers can fare better with unbelievers in the world than with fellow believers in the church? And that should not be. While we're in moral mode, notice too that the thing that causes, interestingly, the change of the brother's plan with regard to Joseph is greed, isn't it? You notice Judah's question there in verse 26, what profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? In other words, but there's profit, there's money here if we instead sell him to these traders who are coming past. If there's one thing that's even stronger in these brothers than the desire for Joseph's blood, it's their desire for money at the end of the day. And they'll take money rather than kill this brother they hate so much. Of course, they disguise it as a bit of compassion, don't they? And they say, well, after all, he is our brother, our own flesh. As if they're actually doing something noble here, but they just want to earn some money, and the 20 shekels would have been a considerable price for them to earn. And of course, this is a common biblical theme, isn't it? The insidiousness of the love of money and how that can wrap its tentacles around us. It's there in Hebrews. We'll come to it eventually, God willing. And we must all be aware of that danger. So there's some mileage then in this moral application, but there's a bigger point here. Joseph is made use of by two New Testament writers. One is the writer to the Hebrews, and I'm sure we'll refer to the way he uses Joseph in future weeks. But the other, well, he's not a writer, he's a speaker. It's Stephen in Acts chapter 7, as he gives that speech to the Sanhedrin. You might just want to turn there for a moment. It's an interesting passage, Acts chapter 7, that long speech that Stephen gives. And you remember then how Stephen, he basically gives the Sanhedrin a summary of Israel's history, and he goes back to Abraham at the start, and verses 1 to 8 are about Abraham, and that's all very uncontroversial. None of his audience would have had any problem with that. He's just talking about how the promise was given to Abraham of a land, and so on. But then, of course, in verse 9, the tone changes, and from then on it's a story of rejection, of Israelite rejection. A key phrase in the whole speech is found, I think, in verse 35. If you just jump there, and you see that phrase, ruler and redeemer, or God sending someone as ruler and redeemer. Ruler and redeemer. And really then, this whole speech from verse 9 onwards is about the people of Israel rejecting three ruler-redeemer figures. And the first one then is Joseph. And that's in verses 9 down to 16. And Joseph then is presented as a ruler. That phrase is used of him in verse 10. And he's presented as a redeemer. He rescued people, including his own people, from the famine, of course, once he was there in Egypt. So Joseph is a ruler and redeemer, and he's rejected. He's rejected by his brothers. Then the second ruler, redeemer figure who's rejected is Moses. And that's specifically the ruler, redeemer that's in view there in verse 35, and various language is used of how he was rejected. Verse 39, our fathers refused to obey him, they thrust him aside. So Joseph is the first ruler, redeemer, rejected. Moses is the second ruler, redeemer, rejected. Who's the third ruler, redeemer, rejected? Well, the third one, of course, is Jesus. Stephen comes to him there in verse 52, the righteous one whom you have now betrayed and murdered. Perhaps would have said more about that had he not then, of course, been interrupted. Now, it's a debated issue that some of you perhaps will have read about at various points or heard about at various points. It's a debated issue. Is Joseph a type of Christ? Is he a legitimate, proper type, that is an Old Testament picture of Christ, a foreshadowing of Christ? And you tend to get then to extremes in the answer of that question, and some will say, oh yes, he certainly is, and they'll see Jesus then everywhere in the Joseph narrative. Or then others at the other extreme will say, oh no, he's certainly not. There's no warrant for thinking that he is. Well, I think there is a warrant for thinking that that Joseph is a type of Christ, and it's here in Acts 7. And the fact, and what Stephen is saying then, is that the treatment that those brothers inflicted on Joseph, it was no just kind of arbitrary one-off thing because they didn't like his fancy coat and all the rest of it. No, it was an early episode of this unfolding story over the centuries. Israel rejecting its God-appointed ruler and redeemer. And that story culminates in Jesus and the rejection of him at Calvary, as we were singing in our third hymn. In fact, you have a hint of that within our passage itself, here in Genesis 37, and there in verse 20. Why is it that they're so passionate about getting rid of Joseph, these brothers? Well, it's not there because he's the father's favourite, nor is it there because he tells tales on them to their father. No, let's see what will become of his dreams. It's his dreams they hate. It's the fact that he is going to be their ruler according to those dreams. They hate that concept. They hate the concept of Joseph ruling over them. They don't want that. And I'm saying then that in that respect, and yes, we need to be sensible how we see Joseph as a type of Christ, not in all kinds of respects, but in this respect, Stephen is saying he's a type of Christ. He's an early ruler and redeemer whom Israel rejected in anticipation of their rejection of the real, the ultimate ruler and redeemer, Jesus Christ. And that means then that the real application for us of this evening is not don't be horrible to your brothers and sisters. The real application is, where do you stand in relation to the ruler and redeemer, Jesus Christ? How are you responding to him? Are you responding as these brothers responded to the miniature, the type, Joseph? Are you saying, like those people in Jesus' parable, we will not have this man rule over us? Or are you saying, he is my ruler, my redeemer? Are you submitting to the ultimate Joseph? It's an important question. It's the most important question all of us must face. How are we responding to God's appointed ruler and redeemer? No, I'm not having him. Or, king of my life, I crown thee now. So an undiminished sovereignty, and then an unfolding story, but then very briefly, an unexpected selection. It's interesting that from an early point in Genesis, there's an expectation of kingship within Israel. So in Genesis 17, part of God's promises to Abraham, he says to Abraham, I will make you exceedingly fruitful, and I will make you into nations, and kings shall come from you. Kings shall come from you. There's been another little hint, actually, even in the previous chapter here, Genesis 36, verse 31. This chapter's all about Esau and about Edom, and it seems a bit irrelevant, but verse 31, these are the kings who reigned in the land of Edom before any king reigned over the Israelites. But it just again feeds into this expectation. Kings are going to come from Israel, within Israel. And it raises the question then, well, where are these kings going to come from? Where is monarchy? Where is rule going to come from within Israel? Now, this chapter doesn't focus, does it, on many of Jacob's sons by name, specifically, individually. It does focus on Reuben. And Reuben, of course, is Jacob's firstborn son. And he's the conventional choice then, isn't he? If kings are going to come from within Jacob's family, if there's going to be a ruling line within Jacob's family, surely it's going to be Reuben's line. He's the firstborn. He's the conventional choice. But this passage is just one that shows what a flop Reuben is. what a wet blanket Reuben is. He has a few pangs of conscience, doesn't he, here about Joseph, and he kind of wants to rescue Joseph, but he can't actually bring himself to do anything significant. And once he discovers Joseph's been sold, he doesn't say, well, let's chase after them and get Joseph back. He just kind of shrugs and says, oh, what am I going to say to Dad? And he's just a bit wet, is Reuben. Then, of course, there's this focus on Joseph, and he's the obvious choice then. If kingship is going to come from one of these sons, surely it's going to be from Joseph. He is so obedient, as we've seen. And of course, within the parameters then of this generation, of this Joseph narrative, he is going to function as ruler. They are going to bow down to him. He is this type of Christ, as we've just been saying. Yet, ultimately, this kingship in Israel is not going to come through Joseph. Who's it going to come through? Well, it's going to come through the other son who's focused on in this chapter. It's going to come through Judah. That's what Jacob will eventually prophesy in chapter 49. That the scepter will come from Judah. And I'm mentioning this, I suppose, partly because I'm not going to focus in this series on the next chapter, chapter 38. I'm not going to do a specific sermon on that passage. Joseph's never mentioned there. But why is it there in the middle of the Joseph narrative? Well, again, I suppose we seize on this from a moral perspective and say, oh, well, it's there to kind of highlight how different Joseph is from Judah, because Judah's so sexually immoral in the way that he goes and sleeps with this prostitute who turns out to be his daughter-in-law and so on, whereas Joseph, in the next chapter, he's so pure when it comes to the temptation that he's facing from Potiphar's wife. And so it's highlighting this contrast so that we'll emulate Joseph instead of emulating Judah. Now, I think there are two reasons why it's there, chapter 38. Number one, because chapter 38 is telling us how Judah had children. And it's through those children that this royal line will come. And long after Joseph has been forgotten, kings, and ultimately the greatest king of all, will come from that line. That's the chosen royal line. And then, secondly, it is there to highlight Joseph's virtue as over Judah's vice, but not simply that we'll go and emulate Joseph instead of Judah. Yes, of course, that's true. But surely to say, what a strange God who chooses as the royal line Judah, the son who goes and sleeps with this prostitute, instead of Joseph, the son who so wonderfully resists Potiphar's wife's seductions. Surely Joseph is the one that Jesus should come from, that kingship should come from, that salvation for the world should come from. Not the man of chapter 38, not this wreck of a man. But no, here we have this unexpected selection, kingship from Judah, the man of chapter 38, not the man of chapter 39. And we see this again and again in the Bible, don't we? You can't second guess God. You can't predict his choices. This book hasn't been invented by men. If it had, it would all be so different. God has written this script. It's so clear. And it's the same script whereby we tonight are Christians, isn't it? Not the eminent and the famous and the celebrities of the world, but us ordinary people. What an unexpected selection we are. Not only is it unexpected that the Messiah should come from this line, but that the people of the Messiah should be us. But that's the God we encounter in the Bible. A God whose ways are inscrutable. A God of mystery and wonder. Let's worship him. Amen. Well, let's close.